Welcome to episode 613 of the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I'm your executive producer, Bob Zarrell. This week's episode is all about Dune and Denis Villeneuve, the famous director who we've done several shows about, Enemy, Arrival, Prisoners, and so many more. Before we get to that episode, though, I want to remind you that we are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or X. Our handle is CriticsPod. We're on I Hate Critics on Facebook. Also, check out the I Hate Critics 1994 podcast on Facebook as well. We're also on YouTube. If you want to listen to the show there, subscribe, hit the little bell to be notified when a new episode drops. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Alexa, all your podcatchers. Please go to Apple Podcasts, so subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. That does help out. Patreon.com/CriticsPod is the best way to support the podcast. And then you can check our TeePublic link out over at IHateCritics.net. All right, without further ado, here is professional film critic Sean Patrick and Jeff Lasseter.
Welcome to the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I am professional film critic Sean Patrick. With me is Jeff.
What's up, everybody?
Jeff is an incredibly talented artist, and of course you can buy his stuff. Where can they buy your stuff?
All my links are at jefflasseter.com, and if you are in the Quad City area this weekend at North Park Mall, I will be slinging my wares at the QuadCon, and that's open all mall hours. So come by and let me know that you heard about it here.
And of course, you do commissions as well, don't you?
I do. I'm working on one right now, actually. As soon as we're done talking tonight, I got to go finish that. So yeah, dogs, kids, your parents, boudoir photography of you or a loved one. But there are weight restrictions on that. I'm just kidding. I say this as a very fat person. No, I'm just kidding.
You said that part about I was just reminded for some reason of a Bill Hicks bit where he wants to get people away from patriotism, and he thought the best way to do that would be to produce American flags with pictures of people's parents fucking. And no one's gonna salute that.
Oh yeah,
you're absolutely right, Bill.
Well, what is a patriot anymore?
Donald Trump. No, I'm kidding.
How did our listenership take to our half an hour talk about the horrible healthcare system in America?
Oh, nobody listened to that episode. It's fine. No, actually, we solved it. I don't know if you noticed. The American healthcare system is now fully functioning, and yes, Everybody can go. So that's great. Oh, we solved the problem.
Go to your psychiatrist, everybody.
All right. We've got one subject for tonight's show, so we'll get to that in just a little bit. But first, the Academy Awards are this weekend, Jeff.
Oh, okay, cool.
A full breakdown of the outcome of the Academy Awards on next week's show. But wanted to get on the record with predictions for tonight, considering this is the last show before the Academy Awards. Jeff, what do you have in mind for the winner for Best Supporting Actress? Emily Blunt, Danielle Brooks, America Ferrara, Jodie Foster, or Divine Joy Randolph?
Well, I think it's going to be America Ferrara. Danielle Brooks is one of my favorite actresses. And just, I think she's just so good at everything she does. And to see her, after watching her for years on Orange is the New Black, I just want to see her succeed. I think she's just great. But there's a lot of buzz between Jodie Foster and America Ferrara. And I don't know. I don't know why. I'm just going to go with America Ferrera because I think it's one of the only, you know, it's one of the only Barbie nominations in the category is supporting. So
I think that's a better, I think that's the best of the two that you mentioned there in terms of one that might win, because they're going to show that clip of America Ferrera doing the speech in Barbie, and that's going to get a huge reaction in the room. But of course, all the votes are already counted. And I think those votes have already been counted for Divine Joy Randolph. She's won every other award this season. The Academy Award is just sitting there, sitting right there, waiting for her. I think, you know, The Holdovers wasn't a very big hit, but she was, and I think she's been a big hit on the awards circuit, and I think that's going to work in her favor, and I think she's walking away with it.
That's a good prediction. She was really good in that. I thought the movie was fine. It was a prestige movie. You know what I mean? That being said, so was American Fiction, and I loved that movie. So who knows?
All right. How about the Best Supporting Actor category? Sterling K. Brown, Robert De Niro, Robert Downey Jr., Ryan Gosling, or Mark Ruffalo?
Oh, my favorite was probably Sterling K. Brown, because I thought what he was doing in American Fiction was nothing you would ever expect from him. But Robert Downey Jr. is absolutely 100% going to win.
I would like that. That's where I'm casting my vote. That said, watching the Oscar buzz, watching things develop, I think Sterling K. Brown has an outside chance of winning this. I think he was a surprise nominee, and I think he was a surprise nominee for a reason, is that there is some sort of rising tide there that maybe most of us haven't noticed because we're not in the middle of it. But I think there is something there. I think people really have taken to that performance, and I think there's a chance that he pulls the upset. I'm thinking Robert Downey Jr., but... watch out for Sterling K. Brown.
I would absolutely love that. While I think that Robert Downey Jr. is the best part of Oppenheimer, Sterling K. Brown as a newly out gay man in American Fiction, where he is doing all the things that all a newly out things. Gay man does.
All the things.
So. He's my favorite of the nominees as far as like his part and his performance. But I think Robert Downey Jr. will probably get it just because of the fact that, you know, Oppenheimer is another prestige movie that I honestly don't think that of the nominations, I think he is the best of the nominations as far as acting goes. So, Cillian Murphy, he's fine, but I don't think he brought to Oppenheimer. I think Oppenheimer succeeded and his performance succeeded. God help me for saying this as a result of Christopher Nolan and his direction. Because Cillian Murphy to me doesn't do a lot that's different. But Robert Downey Jr. was not Robert Downey Jr. in this movie.
Robert Downey Jr. is so dynamic and so, I mean, there's that character. You don't know it going in that he's going to be the ultimate rival to Robert Oppenheimer. And you really, I mean, history has completely forgotten this man for the right reasons, as the movie demonstrates. We know why this man is forgotten. But to see him rise up and become that, and then to watch his fall as well, which you see in, you know, by the end, how he ended up where he ended up and how history judged him. It's like it's utterly fascinating. And that's all coming from Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, the way he embodies that character, gives him life and helps you to care about this guy and his massive ego that is going to be his downfall.
Yeah, he just. In the fact that he wasn't being, you know, Robert Downey Jr., Tony Stark, he he's such a really good actor, and I think like Chaplin, his first nomination, really bore that out. And I think that's one of the reasons that he worked so well as Tony Stark, is because he had all that gravitas from his previous life, and the chops to back it up. So
absolutely,
he's my prediction. My hope is Sterling K. Brown.
Yeah, and Robert Downey Jr. is going to win, but I think watch out for that Sterling K. Brown. Best actress: Annette Bening, Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hüller, Carey Mulligan, or Emma Stone.
Well, I really don't think that we have to split this one, because Lily Gladstone's going to win it, and deservedly so.
Yeah, I think so. I think Lily Gladstone's got to be the favorite. I think everyone else seems to have receded. Carey Mulligan might as well not even be nominated at this point. And Annette Bening kind of snuck in there kind of out of nowhere, just out of the respect that people have for her, I think. I don't see Emma Stone pulling an upset here. As much as I like Poor Things and I love that performance, I don't see it having the seriousness or the gravity to be, you know, like, there's a lot of people who are just going to look at this and say that it's just not enough. It's not substantial enough to be an Academy Award winning performance. Yeah. Whereas obviously you can't argue that with Lily Gladstone.
Lily Gladstone was Killers of the Flower Moon. That, I mean, it was her movie. I don't care what anybody says about Robert Downey Jr. or, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio or Robert De Niro. It was her movie. She was the star. And she was the rock in that movie.
Absolutely.
So,
now, have you heard this controversy, Jeff, about Maestro? There's a controversy going around because a Variety article circulated recently talking to a voter who said, well, I didn't even bother to watch Maestro because a couple of friends of mine told me it wasn't any good.
Was I one of those friends? I didn't
know. What do you think of the idea, though, of people voting for the Academy Award and admitting openly to friends that they didn't watch all the nominees?
Well, I mean, honestly, do you think that they do?
I don't know. I maybe just don't admit it publicly.
So I remember the talk about when Crash won over Brokeback Mountain. I am convinced that people did not watch Brokeback Mountain. They just they watched parts of Crash and thought, oh, yeah, that's about race, and let's do that. Yeah, let's do that instead of the fags. Sorry, that I can say that, you can't. But, you know, I think I don't think everybody watches all the movies, regardless of what they say and if, you know, how quote unquote seriously they take it. I don't think that they do. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. I mean, there's no real reason to take this very seriously. It's still just an award show. I mean, you want the best people to win. You want them to win based on merit, but at the same time, when has anybody ever won on merit?
Crash. I will say this.
Forrest Gump.
Oh, God.
Sorry.
The exception that proves that rule is Moonlight.
True. Very true. How that happened, we'll never know. Best actor: Bradley Cooper, Colman Domingo, Paul Giamatti, Cillian Murphy, or Jeffrey Wright?
Oh, okay. Paul Giamatti will win because he's Paul Giamatti and everybody loved the Holdovers, which, like I said, I thought it was fine. Personally, I would love to see either Jeffrey Wright or Colman Domingo do it. Jeffrey Wright was just the incredulity that he had on everything that was going on around him in American Fiction, you believed it. I never once saw Jeffrey Wright in that movie. I often saw Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers because he was playing Paul Giamatti shtick. I like him. Don't get me wrong. I like him. It's just that was a very Paul Giamatti performance.
It's what you expected of Paul Giamatti.
Yes. I don't necessarily think it was Oscar worthy, but I think that the fact that it's a, you know, The Holdovers is a prestige picture. I think that that carried a lot for him. Mm. Whereas Divine Joy Brown, she was the standout performance in that movie.
So your prediction though is Paul Giamatti.
My prediction is Paul Giamatti. My wish would be Jeffrey Wright.
I wish Jeffrey Wright would win. I don't see it happening, but I wish he would, because it's I think it's the best performance in the category among this group of nominees.
What would be hilarious is if he got up there and he was accepting the award and the police busted in just like in the movie.
I don't know what to predict in this one, honestly. I think this is the most unpredictable category of them all, because really? I don't think there's anyone who stands out front. Even Paul Giamatti, I don't see him as standing out front. When you watch the way that awards have been handed out this season, yes, he's kind of been the guy, but I don't think there is actually a full consensus around any one guy. And I think what might happen in this category, and I'm going to predict it now, Cillian Murphy is going to win based solely on the fact that Oppenheimer is going to win, and it's going to win a lot.
Yeah.
So that brings us to our next. Now let's get the best director. Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall, Martin Scorsese, Killer of the Flower Moon, Christopher Nolan, Yorgos Lanthimos, Jonathan Glazer. Who do you got?
Well, you know, I think that Yorgos Lanthimos could win because of how different Poor Things is, mm-hmm. and how it really that's the one thing I really loved about it, was the direction and how over the top it was, and how it just kind of took you on an actual ride. But I could see him winning, and he's kind of the one that I would like to see win. But this is like the hardest one, because I think everybody could actually really, and anybody here would deserve it. I don't know if Martin Scorsese could pull it off, or if he's like the odds-on favorite. I think Christopher Nolan will get it because Oppenheimer was such a big project. Mm-hmm. I would like to hope, though, that I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I just, again, don't care about Christopher Nolan all that much.
You represent for Bob. There you go. Yeah.
Now, I did not see Anatomy of a Fall.
Right.
That's the only one I have not seen yet. And I've been watching, I started The Zone of Interest and I didn't want to fall asleep. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't want to fall asleep to it, but I work late night lately. Mm-hmm. So it's been hard to not fall asleep after I start a movie. So I just kind of throw on whatever.
Yeah, and especially when we're talking about a foreign film where you're gonna be watching subtitles, it's not easy to stay awake. You need to be fully awake for that. I'm going to predict Christopher Nolan to win. I think Hollywood likes rewarding success. Oppenheimer was a huge success, and I just think that's going to be the main driving force behind his victory. If there's going to be an upset, if there's a long shot, and if I could call a long shot, I would call Jonathan Glazer. I think there is a chance that The Zone of Interest, I mean, the fact that it snuck into the nominations for Best Picture and Best Director shows that there is a block out there, at the very least, that did see this movie and does respect it as much as they should. If there's a chance for an outside upset, that's the one. But I think Hollywood's ready to just crown Christopher Nolan the way they crowned James Cameron years ago.
Do you think he'll yell, "I'm the king of the world"? He should get up there and say,
"I'm the king of destroying the world."
Yes.
Oh, that brings us to Best Picture, which do we even bother? It's Oppenheimer, right?
It's going to be Oppenheimer, but...
It should be Past Lives, but Past Lives isn't going to get anything, so... Yeah. and Perfect Days isn't even nominated, so... I'm fine. I loved Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer is in my top four movies of the year, so I'm all there with Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's fine. It's one of those movies that while I was watching it, I really liked it and I thought it was done very well. And I thought that, but I've seen so many movies this year that I just liked more. I cannot for the life of me understand why Maestro got nominated above some of the other ones like Megan.
Baffling. Shut up.
I'm just kidding. I was seeing if you were paying attention. No, I mean, Maestro is just, it's a movie about a nose. It doesn't even need to be there. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
it's there because show business loves show business. They love watching movies about themselves. They also like the most of things. And Maestro is definitely the most of things. It's the most acting. For sure. It's the most makeup. It's the most this. It's the most that. That's what Hollywood loves. That's why Maestro is there. It's very simple. And yeah, it's surprising that there is any dissent against that movie. But I think Oppenheimer is just so successful that that they were able to overlook Maestro a little bit.
Yeah.
In terms of it being a contender to win, it still got nominated, of course.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
All right, let's get on to the topic of this show, shall we?
How you doing?
Good God.
That's the title of the episode.
How do you live with yourself? How do you live with yourself?
I saw a meme and this was from when the first chapter of the latest Dune came out, and it was Wendy Williams. Her face was pictured over everybody else's face on the Dune poster. It says, "How you doing?" I'm gonna make Bob make this the title.
Oh God! Nothing can top last week's title.
Oh, this is true. I hope people listen all the way to the end.
Not the best title in the show's history, though. I saw that one today. The nipples of Robert Redford. I have no idea what the context was for that. It's 7 years ago. Still the best title we ever had. We're going to talk about Dune in release order. So we're going to go classic first, and then we're going to close on Dune 2. So you want to skip ahead, we'll put chapters in, and you can just jump to Dune 2 if you want. But first, Dune 1984, directed by David Lynch, a famously troubled production of Frank Herbert's remarkable book about houses and spice and Kyle MacLachlan being a little baby man, and this movie was initially supposed to be 4.5 hours long in Lynch's initial creation, and it would have to be. So we end up instead with this movie that has like exposition, credits, exposition, then maybe kind of a movie. Just imagine what it's like to try and take a 4.5 hour original cut and then cut that down to a mere 2 hours and 17 minutes. And you have to, and then you understand why this dialogue sounds like it does. It is putrid. I have a big thing about exposition where if I'm forced to listen to too much of it, like my biggest pet peeve in a movie is like, somebody walks into the room. "Hey, it's my brother. You're my brother. You've been my brother my entire life, brother." I fucking hate that shit.
Wait, are you guys related? Did you read the book?
We've worked together now for 7 years. Oh, have you?
Did you read Dune?
No, I've never read the book.
Okay. So the I listen.
Books can do that. The books are allowed to have exposition. No.
I'm completely agree with you. I just okay. that that is where most of my issues with all of the adaptations come from, or the book.
Mm-hmm. Is the book good?
It's fine. So as everybody knows, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and the meme of the guy looking over the other guy's test, and the test is Dune, and the guy looking over it is George Lucas. I mean, as a big Star Wars fan, I get it. You know, Dune is an epic and all that. I just, as I was listening to it, my favorite parts of it were kind of left out of all the movie. it's fine. It's just not, I didn't connect with it. Mm-hmm. As I was listening, I kept thinking, like, I have a paper book copy of it, but I was like, I've got a bunch of shit to do over the next 2 weeks. I'm going to have to just listen to it, 'cause I won't be able to sit down and read it before I go see the movie. Mm-hmm. So I listened to it as I was doing some stuff, and I kept having to kind of rewind a little bit 'cause I was spacing out, and it's, I guess that in 1965 when it came out and it was a big epic and whatever, I guess I can understand where it would grab everybody's attention. Mm-hmm. And if you're really into science fiction, it's a great science fiction book. I am not huge in, I'm into like space fantasy, Star Wars, that kind of stuff. But, so for me, I kept picturing as I was listening to it, the actors from the modern day one, mm-hmm. like Rebecca Ferguson, but in the kind of set design of the 1984 one, which I had never seen until this weekend either. So mm-hmm. I watched all three Dune movies this weekend, and that was a lot after listening to the book. That was mm-hmm. a lot of Dune.
That's too much Dune.
Well, and then I listened to a podcast today about a book further in the series, and then he kind of caught everybody on how, you know, this what another movie might be. He would think he was on the fifth book, and he was talking about the other books besides just Dune, and I was like, I do not absolutely want to see anything past what we've seen, if it involves mm-hmm. everybody dying and shit and a giant worm, human hybrid and all that. Yeah, that's apparently in the god emperor of Dune, Leto Atreides, which is one of Paul's children that he has, lives to be 3,000 years old and kills off his aunt, who is a charismatic leader, and then lives another 3,000 years and kind of merges with a sandworm.
What the fuck?
Yeah, and turns Arrakis into a lush jungle paradise. I'm just like, God, wasn't this enough? No matter what Dune I have consumed over the last week, I still had a hard time kind of keeping it all straight.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Dune 1984, all it has going for it is memorable, is being memorable. It is intensely memorable. Like mm-hmm. as bad as, because it's bad. It's a bad movie. It's a bad movie, but it's a bad movie made by David Lynch. So it's a bad movie that's made with ambition. And it's not David Lynch's fault that it's bad. He had a vision that he wanted to carry out that happened to be 4.5 hours long that they had to take away from him and cut up. And you know, they're like doing they're doing all that expository bullshit at the beginning without him. You know, they're trying to mm-hmm. work around him as best as possible. And it's just, it's in the end, it's just kind of sad. I think the biggest problem that I have with it is Kyle MacLachlan. He's just such a non-factor. I mean, it's unfair to compare him to Timothy Chalamet, but Chalamet has a presence that Kyle MacLachlan doesn't have. He's better looking. He's a little bit more. He's just a little bit more forceful of a personality. I think they did Kyle MacLachlan a little dirty by making him so dewy eyed all the time. He seems like he's on the verge of tears most of the movie, even when he has to be like the big tough guy at the end. It really does him a disservice as an actor to have him put in that position that way. I just don't feel like they gave him. Maybe his best parts were on the cutting room floor. I don't know, but what they left in the movie was unfortunate. I did. They're really my favorite thing about this movie is seeing Jürgen Prochnow with a beard and carrying around a little dog. I loved that. I'm a big Jürgen Prochnow guy. watching him with a beard and carrying around a little dog. Like, yeah, that's cool. He looks awesome.
Yeah, I mean, did you have to watch this with Amy and MJ? So you guys
talk about I forgot Jürgen Prochnow was in it, so I had to text Amy. I'm like, Jürgen's got a beard and a little dog. You've got to see this. Mm-hmm. It's a running meme on the 94 show. If you're not listening to the 94 show, Jürgen Prochnow is one of our favorite memes.
Yes.
But there are elements of this, like occasionally the production design is you know really spectacular. You can see the elements that Lynch loves, like the body horror stuff, all the tumors on the Harkonnens and their skin, and the idea of that the bad guy floating around like he does in a suit. That's Lynchian. That's Lynch stuff. And there's elements of that does work in the 84 version, but it's buried under stuff that just doesn't work. Like the whole thing is just so bland. It's so bland. There's a lot of buildup about Sting, and Sting's performance isn't really there. And we'll get to that in Dune 2 as well, with that same character is really a big letdown to me in both movies.
Yeah, in the book, he's so much more, and he's more cunning and more more of a kind of a lurking presence. And I think that my one of my issues with Austin Butler is that he should have been in part one as a lurking presence. So
you can see that. We'll get to that, of course, when we get to Dune.
Yeah. But Sting in a loincloth, I mean, that's one of the more memorable things about
it's memorable. He's got like 12 abs.
Yeah.
Tantra is your friend, folks.
Yes, in case you're ever wondering.
Sting is no joke.
No, Sting is not a joke.
But he's also not an actor. He's a presence. He's got great presence. He can stand with those 12 abs and be present.
Yes.
But he is not an actor.
No.
What is there to say? I mean, the action isn't very spectacular. Sean Young is not particularly interesting. Again, it's unfair to compare to her to Zendaya. I think she's got a different challenge. Because Zendaya's got a far better written version of this character.
Totally.
By a country mile. Like, it's not even close how much better written that character is in the new version versus the other one. So it's unfair to say that Sean Young was bad in this, but she's also like incredibly young, and she's gotten this role that is just desperately underwritten, and it's just really unfortunate.
One of the things about the character of Chani is that she's just a girl, you know, she's just a woman, a girl who she's not, you know, she's not this spectacularly made up princess that they make her out to be in 84.
Mm.
You know, and I think Zendaya plays it much closer to what I imagined the character to be.
Mm.
And Sean Young is kind of just Sean Young.
Yeah, she's just pretty and breathless and, you know, kind of a, she's not a damsel in distress because she's not really in all that much distress, but if they'd had railroad tracks to tie her to, I guess maybe that would have been appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
For how they portray the character. Mm-hmm. She's just, again, like Kyle MacLachlan, she's just kind of done dirty also by this edit, which is just, it's so forceful. The edit on this movie is so forceful. You still get a good sense of the story, but it's all coming at you in this just turgid dialogue that just weighs the movie down and prevents there from ever being any kind of momentum in this entire movie.
It hits the beats of the story pretty well. The story told in the book. It's just, it's almost like a Roger Corman movie in the edit. Because it's just like, you know, you can see like it. Remember in Grindhouse when they had, you know, Real Missing? I feel like David Lynch should go back in and recut this with all the stuff that they took out. He should just put in Real Missing.
Yeah. Here's this grand battle that we did. Real Missing. Yeah. Because we gotta get back to the houses and Jose Ferrer, and oh man, it's unfortunate.
Like, Jose Ferrer felt like he was playing in an early '60s costume drama.
Yeah,
and that kind of set the tone for everything for me.
Yeah. Well, that's due in 1984. It's bad. It's as bad as you ever heard. But again, do recall, David Lynch is an incredible director. There are elements here where you can see what David Lynch wanted to do versus what ended up on the screen. I think he's still he's a visionary. I don't love every David Lynch movie, but I love him as an auteur and a thinker and a guy who makes just desperately original films. I think he made the movie he wanted to make, and then they cut it to shreds, and this is what we get.
Well, you know that he was up for Return of the Jedi, right?
Yeah, yeah, I know that.
Yeah, and I think that this was his answer to that. I can't do that, so I'll do this instead, and look what it got you, David.
Yeah, he recovered. He bounced back.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Dune 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve and starring Timothée Chalamet in the role of Paul Atreides. We've got Oscar Isaac as Leto Atreides. We've got Rebecca Ferguson as Paul's mom. We've got just this incredible cast. And, of course,
her name
the director,
is Jessica.
The director, this is just, he's a visionary. He can do anything. Denis Villeneuve is just, he's arguably the best working today. I mean, he takes this, you know, massive epic and makes it feel epic, but he never loses sight of the important aspects of the human element, the making sure that his actors are being served by the script, giving them opportunities to express themselves and be dynamic amid all of this massive spectacle. He's still got to get to the big battles. He's still got to get to, you know, big moments. But he never loses sight of these actors and these characters. And that, to me, is just a talent that so few directors really have. I mean, as you can see, like, there's so many movies that wish they could be this epic. And they get caught up in the sweep. They get caught up in the special effects. They get caught up doing all these millions of things. And they lose sight of their actors. And they just kind of sit back and go, well, hopefully the performance is good. I don't think Villeneuve does that. I think he makes sure that the performance is just as good as everything else he's doing.
Yeah, this is what I think Dune is with a 2020 is, with a 2020s lens. And that, by that I mean, the story in the book is very, it's almost kind of grounded to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it was an epic, but a grounded epic, if that makes any sense. And this is much more sweeping and really kind of adds a grandeur to it that I think the story needs.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous movie. It's utterly gorgeous.
So yeah, that was what I noticed first.
There were a lot of questions going into this about Timothée Chalamet being a leading man, whether he had that kind of leading man presence was a question going into it, and a reasonable one. And I think he stepped forward and really owned this character. And I think he brings dimensions to this character that many people might not think, because people like think of characters like this and they assume that they need like a bigger, you know, more masculine presence. And I think what he brings to this is the kind of necessary vulnerability that can turn into a much more dynamic character. And I think that's what he brings to this, is a vulnerability that is not just being, you know, dewy-eyed and crying all the time poor Kyle MacLachlan is left in the first one. And there's so much more to it. I think he's doing a lot of different emotional things with this role.
Yeah, Timothée Chalamet, he's a good actor, and I would have with his appearance. That's just my own. That was my only kind of read on him.
His hair.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I mean, he's got his hair is the same in everything he does. I mean, Little Women and Wonka. It's all, you know. He's always Timothée Chalamet. I think, you know, he handles the role well. There were a couple people that I could have thought of other than him, but I hate to say the flavor of the month, but you know what I mean. He's like your go-to for stuff now. I really got the sense over the two movies of him, and I didn't get it from the text of the book or the first movie, but I really got it from him of leaning into your own hype and starting to believe it, mm-hmm. and, you know, making a prophecy come true in your own head.
It's funny because that kind of mirrors Chalamet in real life when you think about it. Because he wanted to be a movie star. He's had to kind of develop the idea of becoming the movie star that everybody else says he is, and that's mm-hmm. that is a nice mirror, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing I know him from is spreading chlamydia all over NYU, allegedly.
Jesus.
Allegedly. But, you know, he's going to be a very good actor someday if he leans it. If he takes I don't mean like the drugs and everything, but if he takes more of a Robert Downey Jr. approach to things, where he, you know, he does the stuff that is fun, like Wonka and to a certain extent Dune, which is not, you know, it's still a genre film.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw him in Call Me By Your Name, I was like, oh, he's going to be really good. And I see it like every performance I see him in, it's a little less Timothée Chalamet and a little more of the character.
I think I've felt that way. I feel like with him, for me, he has these great eyes that I think communicate so much more depth than any of the dialogue that he delivers. I think he's mm-hmm. great at being present in a scene. I think you watch him operate among other actors. Like, he seemed to be delighted to be in a scene with, his friend and trainer. God damn it.
Oh, Josh Brolin?
Josh Brolin, yeah. He seemed to be absolutely delighted to be in a scene with Josh Brolin, and but he was different with him than he was with other people, which is kind of a very human thing to be, because we're all like that. Mm-hmm. We've all got people in our lives who make us into kind of different people when we're around them. And to just have that knack to understand that little tiny basic part of humanity is so interesting. But then he seems to know that he's got to build this character from the ground up and give this character dimensions that are not on the page. And I thought he was fantastic at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I always, when I listened to it, knowing it was him, you know, I kept going back to a young, like if Adam Driver was 20 years old, I could totally see him as Paul Atreides.
Yeah, I can see that.
And that's where my mind kept kind of putting Adam Driver's face onto Timothée Chalamet while I was listening. But then watching the movies, I could totally, you know, it totally got me with him. So I think
go ahead.
I think, though, that the standout performance of both the first and the second was Rebecca Hall or Ferguson, sorry. Rebecca Ferguson, the restraint she played in the first movie, and with the secret that comes out in part two about her lineage, you know that she's got that, you know, like deep down, even though, you know, allegedly she just found out about it.
Right.
It's a little more, it's always there in the back of her head. And I think she, you know, she has a certain affinity for some of the stuff she's forced to do or asked to do because of her lineage. And I think that that comes, I think that comes through her performance in part one, where she knows what's coming. And maybe as the character, she's not 100% clear what's coming, but she knows that something like that is coming in her life and why Paul is so receptive to the Bene Gesserit teachings. So
what I love about that performance is that there, for a lot of actors, there's going to be a temptation to see that role and see, I could play the crazy eyes. I can get going. I can bite the walls with this performance. And she doesn't do that. And I appreciate that so much, because that, I mean, there are opportunities in every scene she's in to where she could go over the top and really try and make you believe everything that she's doing. And
she could be Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah. I don't agree necessarily, but I thought she was very good in this. But
no, she was. I'm just her character throughout, you know, all the iterations is the most crazy eyes.
Yeah, she's the most thin skinned and insecure of all the characters, and there's a tendency there to play that. But I think I just love the way that Rebecca Ferguson chooses to act as opposed to act.
Yeah,
there's a big difference in that tone right there.
Even at the height of her powers, throughout the both movies, she's still very restrained and very I don't want to say meek, but reserved. And even, you know, like she does the voice, and even then, it's only momentarily, and she's very even keeled the rest of the time.
Plays it close to the vest. Yeah. And when she needs to, she's like a lightning strike. And that is just such a great way to play that character.
Completely tactical.
And I loved Oscar Isaac. I thought his realization of Leto Atreides, the fatherly way he portrays that character with Chalamet, I thought their bond was very believable. I just loved the his approach to it. He seems like the kind of guy who would inspire the rest of this story to happen as it does.
Yeah. Well, and he also his subtext is as good as Rebecca Ferguson.
Ooh, absolutely.
His, His Absolutely. Subtext is he can almost see what's going to happen, but he's also got that little bit of, you know, when you get something you really, really want and you're trying not to let on how excited you are about it.
Yeah.
That's how I took him in, you know, when he realizes that he's going to be the Duke of this world and he was super, super happy that he got something that he really, really wanted, but he's trying to be restrained and dignified like a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But inside he's a little boy going, yippee.
And he plays that fucking brilliantly in those final scenes leading up to his death. It's just, so good. Dune 1 is fantastic. I think Dune 2 is fantastic as well. And the thing that I love about Dune 2, Jeff, is this real conflict that they built into the relationship between Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya, between Paul Atreides and Chani. It's such a real and believable, you know, thing that you can see the division there. You can see she is well established in how she feels about the idea of a messiah, about the idea of there just being a destiny in the world that is out of your control. She fully believes in the human heart and the ability to do the things that you want and not having this oppressive thing on top of you. And he is being pulled. He wants to foster her feelings and be part of that. But he also has this very realistic, very understandable desire to protect people around him and seeing that the only path here is to become this messiah, become this all-powerful being who can protect people and even can protect Chani, but can't have the life that he wants. That is a great dynamic. It is incredibly well realized. It's a meaty piece of drama that the movie really chews on.
Yeah. Completely agree.
On top of it all, it's also just as gorgeous as the first film. I mean, the vistas, the worms, all of that stuff is so incredibly realized. I thought maybe, perhaps based on the pre-release hype, that I might not be able to get past the look of the worms because of all the jokes that people have been making. But I got past it pretty quick once Chalamet was riding that worm and they were riding them into battle. I thought that was awesome looking.
It was the best scene of him riding a worm since Call Me By Your Name.
God, we gotta end the show on that.
Riding the worm.
Bob, you have your choice now. There's so many standout things about Dune 2. There's so many incredible things, but one that let me down was Austin Butler. Not his performance. I don't think he was bad. I think he's let down by the hype. I think they centered so much of the ad campaign around Fade Rotha and that knife fight with Paul Atreides that it makes you think that he's the big bad, and he's not. He is not the big bad by any stretch. In fact, there really isn't a big bad. I mean, Christopher Walken is the emperor, and he's kind of the one that's standing against Paul Atreides the most. But realistically, like, the side that we're on, Paul Atreides' side, is winning most of the time in this movie. Like, it's kind of an ass kicking from the beginning and doesn't really let up for much of the movie. There's a comeback briefly, but for the most part, they're pretty dominant. I found that to be a refreshing way. Like, seeing the good guys actually be capable is actually something we so rarely see. In big action movies like this, you often see they give the villain every, you know, possible advantage to create underdogs. And I don't think Paul is necessarily an underdog here. And I think that also plays into kind of the future of the films, where he's maybe not going to be the bad guy, but he's going to have to do bad things to be the good guy, which is, again, another great piece of drama.
Yep. Yeah, I think that when you're buying into your own hype and you're trying to make others believe it as well so that you can get what you want to get done, where's the line? You know, and I think he straddles that very well as far as his performance, knowing what he's going to have to do versus what he wants to do and why does he need to marry Florence Pugh if he really loves, you know, he saw the mistakes of his mother not being married to his father and what that did to her. Why would he want to do the same thing to Chani? You know, it's in the book too, it's a little more spelled out, and there's a little, you know, there's a little more dialogue between all involved. That being said, I thought that for what it was handled very well in the film. When I saw the first one, the casting announced for the first one, I'm like, all it's missing is Anya Taylor-Joy as the Princess Irulan, because she's, you know, she has been in everything. And then they announced Florence Pugh for that role, and I was like, oh. And then, of course, up pops Anya Taylor-Joy as a princess. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes more sense. So.
I mean, how could you not cast her in this? She's got that alien beauty that is just absolutely built for movies like this.
Yeah, yeah. And the part that she got is even more suited to her, because, you know, her character is just a flash forward, really, of Paul Sutter, and she does have that alien look about her. You know, her eyes are a little further apart than most people, and her, you know, the shape of her face is so kind of iconic. And then, yes, that's exactly who she should be.
Absolutely. Because
this is a child who should not have survived, even, much less thrived. So
I think Dune 2 is even better than Dune 1. But they're both, I love them both. I think they're both great movies. And I'm not a big sci-fi guy. I don't really love science fiction. I like Star Wars, the first three. The last kind of part of the last trilogy was okay too. But I don't love science fiction the way a lot of people do. I certainly don't love Star Trek. I'm not a Star Trek guy. Don't hate it. I just don't care. The movies have been bad.
Star Trek to me was always, you know, we've got Star Wars at home.
That's a little harsh.
Well, no, that is literally when I was a kid and I wanted to see it over and over and over again in the theater, my mom would say, you can watch it on TV at home. She did not differentiate between Star Wars and Star Trek. So therefore, we have Star Wars at home was an actual thing at my house.
Nice. All right, let's do a quick round of flick chart, shall we?
Okay.
High Art, 1998, or Made in Manhattan?
High Art.
High Art, by a lot. Yeah, High Art is a very good, very underrated film.
Yes, it is.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre or My Girl?
Oh, wow. No.
His glasses. He needs his glasses. It's mandatory. It's mandatory. I have to make women cry. Uh-huh. Every woman listening is just bawling their eyes out now.
I make women cry by telling them I'm not available. I make men cry by telling them I am available.
Gen X women, I should say. Mostly Gen X women have seen My Girl.
Hey, I want to, if you've gotten this far in the show, if you come out and see me this weekend, I have a digital copy of the movie Psycho for the first person who comes up to me and says, hey, I listened to you on the podcast. So,
very cool. A little treasure for somebody who's still listening at this point.
Yeah, if you're still here.
Or if you looked at the chapters and you saw a flick chart and you're like, I'm going there.
Whatever it takes.
Like I said, it's Treasure of the Sierra Madre, by the way, is the winner.
Yeah.
Let's see here. American Pie 2 or Terminator Dark Fate.
Terminator Dark Fate. Which one is that?
That's the 2019 Terminator movie.
Oh, with where they kill John Connor.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, let's go with that one.
I'm going with American Pie 2.
I don't care. I don't
Dark
care.
Fate. That movie's garbage. I hated Dark Fate. I hate the whole Terminator franchise. So there you go. No, I love Terminator 2. I'm only joking. The rest of the Terminator movies can go fuck themselves. But no, Coin Flip goes to American Pie 2, even though it's not very good. let's see here. Let's get movies people have actually seen. What do you say? Nosferatu, 1922, or Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein?
Ooh. I like, we talked about this.
Ago. Yeah.
I like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein because they don't infantilize the monsters. But I'm going to say Nosferatu.
Same, but yeah, same exact note as well, because Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is a great movie. Everyone should see it. Wicker Man 2006 or The Grudge 2004?
The bees!
Not the bees!
gonna go with The Grudge.
Yeah, I guess. I hate them both. They're both trash. But Wicker Man's kind of more appreciable trash in some ways. But Wicker Man is very long on the same.
Yeah.
It's hard. The Grudge, I guess, can win. The Astronaut's Wife, starring Johnny Depp, or Green Street Hooligans, starring Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam?
I don't think I ever saw that one.
No. Oh. Well, we'll skip it then.
Sorry.
The Astronaut's Wife or How High?
Is How High the one with that's not Natalie.
Method and Red.
Yeah. The Astronaut's Wife.
Really?
No.
Going with How High.
I don't think I saw How High.
It's just a weed movie. They're just being funny high.
Oh, okay.
Astronaut's Wife wins. All right. The River Wild or Wild Things?
Ooh. Meryl Streep or topless Denise Richards?
Don't forget Kevin Bacon's dick.
Oh, this is true. This is true. How could I forget that?
it's a meme on this show. Come on. Can't mention Wild Things without mentioning Kevin Bacon's dick.
I'm going to actually pick Wild Things. That was a thoroughly enjoyable movie when it came out.
It's pure trash, but it's better trash than the Wild River Wild.
Yeah.
Over the Hedge or Spider-Man No Way Home?
Spider-Man No Way Home.
Definitely, yeah. Let's see. That is not a movie. Also not a movie. Face Off or The Gentlemen?
Face Off, 110%. Fucking hate The Gentleman.
Let's see, The Night Before with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt or Cool Runnings?
The Night Before.
Yeah, Night Before is pretty funny.
That was pretty funny.
Jesus Camp or... What's the other choice here? The other choice will be Bird Box.
Jesus Camp, that was a fucking scariest. Like, that was way scarier than Bird Box.
More people need to see fucking Jesus Camp.
That movie is. You want to talk about groomers?
Oh my God.
That fucking movie is grooming children left and right.
No doubt.
Didn't that little boy kill himself or something?
It's possible.
He got in trouble.
I've not followed up on it, so I don't know. I'm terrified to know anymore.
Yeah,
Footloose, 1984, or Girl Interrupted?
Girl Interrupted. I don't like Footloose.
Are you serious? Girl Interrupted is fucking trash.
I don't like Footloose. I don't like Footloose.
Oh, let's see here. Footloose wins.
Okay, that's fine, but I don't like it.
Girl Interrupted is so bad, dude.
It's got Angelina Jolie being weird in it.
The whole thing is weird. Frailty or the Maze Runner?
Frailty.
Frailty, yeah, that's no question about that one. Maze Runner franchise, I'm glad that one died the way it did. It is awful.
Well, plus the fact that it has Jim Caviezel before he went off the fucking deep end. And lost his entire career.
Good. Midnight in Paris or Overboard 1987?
Midnight in Paris. I would have, 10 years ago, I would have picked Overboard because I just had such good memories from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, talk about problematic now.
Right. Right. This will be the last one. Dreamgirls 2006 or Bambi?
So I'm just going to make you laugh one last time before and we should maybe title the episode this again. But years ago, I got my best Twitter engagement when it was change one letter and ruin a movie. And instead of Dreamgirls, I put Cream Girls.
Fucking hell. Jesus Christ.
Don't ask what's wrong with me. Nobody knows.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
How do you do it?
How do I ruin the show every week? I don't know. You tell me.
Talk to you later, Jeff.
Bye.